privacy. There was no room aboard Hesperus for anything but utilitarian efficiency. We all felt crowded, cramped. I had to fight off incipient claustrophobia whenever I slid into my berth. I felt like Dracula coming home for a good day's sleep. The bridge was especially cramped. The comm center was nothing more than a console, shoehorned in a bare few centimeters from the captain's command chair. I had to twist myself into a pretzel shape to get close enough to Risa's chair to see her screen. I could feel Deschamps' breath on the back of my neck. She was ignoring me, her dark eyes intently focused on the EVA displayed on the main screen before her. Rodriguez and the two other techs were outside in their spacesuits, clambering over the heat shield, checking every square centimeter of it. Maybe Fuchs's ship has broken down, I thought aloud. Wishful thinking, actually. Maybe he's in trouble. Risa shook her head, fluttering her butchered hairdo. Lucifer is telemetering its system status back to IAA headquarters on the regular data channel, same as we are. The ship's still in orbit with all systems functional.
Then why doesn't he answer our call, I wondered.
He doesn't want to, said Deschamps.
I turned to face her, not exactly an easy thing to do in the jammed confines of the bridge.
Why not?
She gave me a frosty smile.
Ask him.
I glared at her. She was making a joke of my effort to contact Lars Fuchs. There was only the three of us on the bridge. Rodriguez's chair was empty.
I could relay our call through IAA headquarters, Risa suggested. He might reply to us if the request came through them.
He won't, Deschamps said flatly. I know Fuchs. He's not talking to us because he doesn't want to, and that's that. Reluctantly, I accepted her assessment of the situation. Fuchs was going to remain silent. The only way we would learn of what he was doing would be to access whatever data he was sending back to the International Astronautical Authority in Geneva. Very well, I said, squeezing between Deschamps and the display screen she was watching. I'm going to the observation port to do my news broadcast. Stay clear of the airlock, Deschamps warned. Tommy and the others will be coming back in less than 10 minutes.
Right, I said as I ducked through the hatch.
The main passageway ran the length of the gondola. It was so narrow that Rodriguez joked that a man could fall in love squeezing past someone there. Before we left Earth, the question of news coverage had come up. Should we bring a reporter along with us? Back when I thought I'd be bringing some of my friends along on the journey, I had been all in favor of the idea. I thought the Nets would love to send a reporter to Venus, and I had several friends who could qualify for the role. For a while, I even considered asking Gwyneth to be our reporter-historian. Live broadcasts from the mission couldn't fail to get top ratings, I figured. Unfortunately, the Net executives saw it differently. They pointed out to me that newscasts from Hesperus would be interesting the first day or two, but they'd quickly become boring on a long voyage out to Venus. They admitted that once we got there, live reports from Venus would be a sensational story, again for a day or two. But afterward, the story would lose its glamour and become nothing but colorless, tedious routine.
It's science stuff, one of the junior executives, a sometime friend of mine, in fact, told me. Science stuff is boring.
They certainly were not willing to pay a reporter's expenses and insurance. It was Deschamps who suggested that I serve as the expedition's reporter, the face and voice of the Hesperus's mission.
Who better? She asked rhetorically.
I like the idea. It eliminated the need to carry an extra person along with us. I would file a personal report on the expedition's progress every day. I would become a household figure all around the Earth-Moon system. I really thought that would be terrific. Even if the Nets wouldn't feature my broadcasts every day, people could access them whenever they wanted. I often wondered as I went through my daily report if my father ever watched me. Deschamps was no fool. Removing the need to bring a reporter with us, she had also removed any possible objections I could raise about her replacing our astronomer with a biologist. Her daughter, fait accompli. She had manipulated me beautifully, and I hardly even minded it, although we both knew we didn't need a biologist aboard. Deschamps did it for personal reasons. Yet I didn't mind. I was actually pleased that Marguerite was with us. Except for my daily news report, I had no real duties aboard Hesperus. Time hung heavily as we coasted out to Venus and then established orbit around the planet. Marguerite had little to do also as far as the ship's duties were concerned, although she usually seemed busy enough when I went looking for her. Often she was in the little cubbyhole that had been converted into her laboratory.
After leaving the bridge and heading for the observation port in the nose of the gondola, I naturally passed by her lab, which was smaller than a phone booth. The accordion fold door was pulled back, so I stopped and asked her, "Are you busy?"
"Yes," said Marguerite.
It was a silly question. She was pecking at the keyboard of a laptop, one of several she had propped along the compartment's chest-high shelf. There was no room in her lab for a chair or even a stool. Marguerite worked standing up.
"Oh, I was on my way to do my news report, and I thought I'd stop in the galley for a few minutes."
My voice trailed off. She was paying no attention to me, tapping at the keyboard of one laptop with a finger while she clicked away on a remote controller with her other hand, changing the images on one of her other screens. The images looked like photomicrographs of bacteria or something equally distasteful. Either that or really bad primitive art. I shrugged, conceding defeat, and continued down the narrow passageway to the galley. It was nothing more than a set of food freezers and microwave ovens lining one side of the passageway, with a single stark bench on the other side, where one of the gondola's oblong windows showed the massive curving bulk of the planet below, gleaming like a gigantic golden lamp. I slumped down on the bench and gazed out at Venus's yellowish clouds. They shifted and changed as I watched. It was almost like staring into a fire, endlessly fascinating, hypnotic. The clouds' hue seemed to be slightly different from one orbit to another. At the moment, they looked almost sickly, bilious. Maybe it's just me, I reasoned. I felt like that, sad and sick and alone.
"Mind if I join you?"
I looked up, and there was Marguerite standing over me. I shot to my feet. "Pull up a section of bench," I said brightly. She sat next to me, and I caught a scent of perfume, very delicate, but a wonderful contrast to the metallic starkness of the ship.
"I'm sorry I was short with you back there," she said. "I was running the latest UV scans of the atmosphere. Sometimes it gets pretty intense."
"Oh, sure, I understand." Marguerite was still wrapped up in her work.
"Something down in those clouds absorbs ultraviolet light," she said.
"You think it's biological? A life form in the clouds?" She started to nod, then thought better of it. As if she were a long-experienced scientist, she buried her enthusiasm and answered noncommittally,
"I don't know. Perhaps. We won't know for certain until we get down into the clouds and take samples."
Without thinking, I argued, "What about all the sampling the unmanned probes did years ago? They didn't find any evidence of living organisms." Suddenly, Marguerite's dark eyes snapped with annoyance.
"They weren't equipped to. They all carried nephelometers to measure droplet size, but not one of them carried a single instrument that could have detected any biological activity. A Shetland pony could have flown by, and those dumbass robots would never have noticed."
"There weren't any biological sensors on any of the probes?"
"Not one," she said. "Venus is a dead planet. That's the official word."
"But you don't believe it?"
"Not yet. Not until I've looked for myself."
I felt a new respect for Marguerite. She could be just as much a tigress as her mother in matters that she cared about.
"How much longer will we stay in orbit?" she asked.
I hunched my shoulders. "We're scanning the equatorial region with radar, looking for any sign of the wreckage of my brother's ship."
"Wouldn't it be all smashed into small pieces?"
"Probably not," I answered. "The atmosphere's so thick that his ship would have gone to the bottom like a ship sinking in the ocean back home. I mean, the pressure down at the surface is like our oceans, a kilometer or more below sea level." She thought about that for a moment.
"So it wouldn't be like a plane falling out of the sky on Earth?"
"Or like a missile hitting the ground. No. More like the Titanic settling on the bottom of the Atlantic."
"You haven't found anything yet?"
"Not yet," I admitted. Hesperus was in a 2-hour equatorial orbit. We had circled the planet 30 times so far.
"How much of a chance is there that you'll spot something?"
"Well, we know where he first entered the atmosphere, the latitude and longitude. But we can only guess where he might have drifted while he was in the clouds."
"He didn't have a tracking beacon?"
"Its signal broke up a lot once he went into the cloud deck, so we've got to scan a pretty wide swath along the equator." Marguerite looked past me, out at the clouds swirling across the face of Venus. She stared at them as if she could get them to part by sheer willpower. I watched the profile of her face, how much she looked like her mother. The same face.